Is it too late for you to talk about the keto diet?
I mean, what's to talk about other than, you know, I still enjoy getting into arguments with keto zealots because I'm like, guys, you do know that I wrote the book, not a book, the book on the topic. I'm like, you are arguing with the wrong person about this. I don't know. I mean, what's to discuss exactly?
Well, I guess we should start by defining what the ketogenic diet is.
Sure.
Should then go over why you should do it or why it is said that you should do it. And last, if you do it, how should it be done?
Sure. So first, let's go back to the history, which is that the ketogenic diet, when it sort of first developed, was actually for epilepsy. So way back in the day, someone figured out that total fasting was a treatment for epilepsy. Nobody knew why, just was. The problem is you cannot fast forever because eventually you waste away. So they wanted to come up with a way to mimic fasting while eating. And it turns out that the ketogenic diet does that. Metabolically, it is very similar to fasting while eating food. So that was it's really its first use. And then it fell out of popularity in like the early 20th because epilepsy drugs started to be developed and it was forgotten at the time. And then somewhere, I forget when, it was a father whose child had drug-resistant epilepsy who started researching it and repopularized the ketogenic diet for epilepsy treatment. And that's a whole separate book. And it's a whole separate thing. I did not write about that in my book. It's a very, because the ketogenic diet as it's set up for epilepsy is different than the way it should be set up for fat loss or performance. I only mention that just for historical, but it is important because people still conflate the two. Because one thing that was critical for epilepsy treatment, or was thought to be critical, frequently there was this critical fat to protein ratio, and there was this thing, there's still an article on my website called the ketogenic ratio that was basically a measure of how protein, carbs, and fat were either pro-ketogenic or anti-ketogenic. And it for epilepsy treatment, it seemed like part of it was developing a certain deep level of ketosis. And you could only do that by keeping protein relatively low and fat extremely high. But that was specifically, and anybody listening to this, well, I mean, I don't know how you edit these videos together, but if you just heard our previous discussion about the criticality of sufficient protein, you can already see why that's a problem. Because the ketogenic epilepsy diet had to reduce protein or keep it low, because protein is technically anti-ketogenic for a reason.
Right.
But where I think it...
Yeah, we'll get into that later.
So, and I think it probably like existed in some form or fashion. Like I think they tried to use it for type 1 diabetes treatment in the early 20th, like without really knowing what, you know, I think the logic was, well, they can't produce insulin relative to carbs. We should probably not feed them carbs. But where the ketogenic diet really took off, where it truly entered the public consciousness, was in the 1970s, and it was due to a singular book, The Atkins Diet Revolution, which may go down in history as the singularly most popular diet book of all time. Don't swear me to that, but it was a worldwide phenomenon. And the basic gist of it was that Dr. Robert Atkins was overweight and unhappy and stumbled upon some very early, and I will come back to this, very crappy research on very low carbohydrate diets for weight loss. And he went on it and it helped and it became his personal salvation. And he described the state of ketosis, which I'll come back to in a second, as being better than sex and sunshine. And that's not a joke. It's in the book. But again, that's part of the salesmanship. So basically, he pushed this entire idea. And it's interesting. It's really easy to crap on him in hindsight. Like, in the 70s, we didn't know nothing about nothing. And the data that was available then was not. But he did kind of make the argument. He was like, okay, you've got a metabolism, a physiology that's become unbalanced. Imbalanced? Imbalanced
They both work.
No longer properly balanced in one direction where it's not handling carbohydrates. And this is like, look, the idea of insulin resistance and syndrome X and like that, this was not a thing. Or if it was, it was in the earliest days because nobody knew nothing about nothing. That to correct an imbalanced physiology, you needed an imbalanced diet. And there's a certain logic to that. And I'll come back to that in terms of when ketogenic diets might have their greatest utility. So he proposed this diet where all that mattered was that you had to reduce your carbohydrates below 30 grams a day. And other than that, you can eat as much as you want. And it took the world by storm. And it worked. Now, the reason he said it worked is not why it worked. It worked because people ate less. But he was claiming it had a metabolic advantage. And here's where that idea still persists to this day. But to understand why, you have to understand the papers that it was being based on. Because again, keep this in context. 1970s, nobody knew nothing about nothing. Especially not body composition. And this is important. So several studies had been done. They were all very short term, 4 or 5 days. And here's what they did. 2,000 calorie ketogenic diet, 2,000 calorie carb-based diet. And over 5 days, at the same calorie level, the ketogenic diet would lose weight. Weight. Not weight. They would lose body weight. But wait, there's more. This is a heavyweight discussion. Okay, I'll stop. I'm going to get punchy now that it's late. Aha! If you're losing body weight at the same calorie level on a ketogenic diet, must have a metabolic advantage. Well, nobody knew from water weight loss.
Yeah.
Which is what it obviously was. Later studies would come where they would put him in a deficit, and here's what would happen. Keto diet would get this huge drop over about 4 or 5 days, and then it would slow down. And the carb-based diet would be here. So the slope of the actual weight loss was the same. The first 4 or 5 days was just water loss. So it was 5 pounds of water, then the real weight loss. And these were identical for the same calorie level. But nobody knew about body composition. They were still focusing only on scale weight changes. So while it's easy to criticize now, or even then to a degree, they knew what they knew and they didn't know what they didn't know. So just keep that in context. Now, there were other things that came out of it. One of his dumber ideas was the fat fast. Because they'd done a study where they're like, we gained 80% fat with some protein. And they lost all this weight in a week. So he's like, when you plateau, you should try eating more dietary fat and do a fat fast. And that shit is still around in the keto community. It was water. Eating more fat does not make you lose fat. Eating more fat makes you lose less fat. You might lose weight because of water. So papers would be written in the late 70s. There's a classic. Easy weight loss is like the illusion of glycogen storage. And basically pointed out, like we know that 1 gram of carbs stores 3 to 4 grams of water. When you take all the carbs out of the diet, you drop water like a maniac. Anywhere from, I've seen feedback I've gotten, 1 to 15 pounds in 3 days, depending on body weight. I can drop a solid 7 pounds in 3 days on low carb. And I'm a little guy. Bigger guys can lose more. There's other mechanisms that are going on. When you insulin causes the kidneys to resorb water. So when insulin drops on a low carb diet, you lose body water. This is known. That was explaining all the early weight loss, the supposed metabolic advantage. Now, it's not that keto diets didn't cause fat loss. They did. But that initial rapid loss was water. The danger, which also means that when you reintroduce carbs, your body weight spikes. So what do people think? Oh, eating no carbs makes you lose weight and eating carbs makes you get... Now realize, this wasn't even new. Vince Guaranda, his cutting diet was a low-carb, eat as much as you can eat diet. That would actually been around in the bodybuilding subculture prior to Atkins. But then when you actually, when the studies came out later in the 80s, the average person on keto was eating about 1600 calories. Yeah, it's just a low. Of course it is. It's a reduced calorie diet. It has to be. If 70% of your normal calories are carbs and you take those out, you will eat less. If you're eating whole foods, that's it. That's fine. Now, like I said, it took the world by storm. And there was some other stuff in there, like, you know, some of it. Well, there's one thing that actually turns out to be more or less right. I'll come back to that, which had to do with transitioning out of the diet. And like there was, you know, all this thing about, like I said, ketones better than sex and sunshine and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, I'm sure there was some stuff about insulin and glucagon because that was, you know, back mobilizing body fat and et cetera. But anyways, basically like keto diets caused more weight loss than the same calories of carbs, ergo metabolic advantage, ergo. And whatever, it worked. And then the AMA came out and they wrote an entire paper decrying him and the diet as dangerous and ketoacidosis, which is, doesn't occur in non-diabetics and all this other, because there were some mineral losses, you know, there could be some issues. I think one of the things that really buried it, so to speak, was that in the late 70s, sort of feeding on this, and there's a bunch of variations. My favorite, the drinking man's diet. Because realize in the 70s, dieting was what women did. Men did not diet. Period. But someone repackaged the Atkins diet as the drinking man's diet. It was just Atkins, but it allowed for a good solid martini every night.
Oh,
you can find a picture. If you go Google it, there is a picture of Frank Sinatra, the chairman of the board, reading that book with a drink in his hand. And that is how you market dieting to men. You can lose weight and you get to drink. Kid you not, you cannot be just.
Yeah, we have a product in Australia called the Man Shake. And I believe in some of their advertising, they said, well, you can lose weight while drinking as long as you have the Man Shake.
Yeah, beautiful. Beautiful, brilliant.
And they've come out with the Lady Shake since.
Well, yeah.
In a different font.
Well, and there is some data. I looked at this like, whereas most studies are like 80% men, 20% women, dieting literature is exactly the opposite. It is almost like 80% women. And some researchers raised the question, are the results coming out of these studies applicable to men? Do we need male-centric weight loss studies? And there's been a few papers on this, and these are hilarious. And this gets into the idea that, again, I'm going to grossly generalize, and this is grossly generally true and not exclusively true. Women's diet studies and diet groups tend to be very much about group dynamics, right? We got Weight Watchers here. You go to your weekly weigh-ins. It's all about support. Men are about competition. So in the men's weight loss studies, they're like, first we divided them up by sports teams. So we had them decide which sport cult they were going to follow. Then their weekly weight loss had to do with how many points they scored. And if you lost enough weight, you could get points. And it was basically, they turned into a head-to-head competition because men love to compete with one another. And it worked. So yeah, there is some certain logic to doing it that way. But in the late 70s, there was this book that came out called The Last Chance Diet. It was by these two physicians.
I know where this goes.
Yep, because I've written about it repeatedly. It was a low-carb diet. Basically a protein sparing modified fast more than anything that was,
which is relying, a ketogenic diet without the carb, without the fat. you're just ingesting protein. That's what a PSMF means.
Correct. But it was based around a collagen protein that they sold, which is zero biological value and didn't contain any minerals, right? At least eating whole food will give you some sodium, potassium. They were providing zero and zero protein. And a bunch of people had like cardiac tissue lost and went into cardiac arrest, and a bunch of people died. And between that and the AMA, that was kind of the end of Atkins. Also, that was about the time in the early 80s where the data on, dietary carbohydrates can't be converted and stored as fat, ergo, just eat less than 10% fat. And like that's, there was just a shift in cultural mindset. And so Atkins kind of fell out, as dietary fads always do. Then the 80s would pass on. And then we entered the 90s, and that's when the zone was a thing, which was moderate carbs, moderate fat, moderate protein. Then as we re-entered the late 90s, ketogenic diets started to make a resurgence. Now, that's when I got involved, because they started it. That's where they started in the athletic arena. Mara DePasquale introduced the anabolic diet, which is a cyclical ketogenic diet, 5 days of ketogenic diet, and then 2 days of eating crap. Dan Duchesne would release Body Opus, also a cyclical ketogenic diet, 5 days of low carb, high fat, followed by 2 days of a meticulous carb load, which separated from the anabolic diet. Because DePasquale was like, eat junk food. No kidding. And it was all rat research. And it was basically they were trying to clear drugs from the WBF. Whole separate story. So that's when I got reintroduced to them. But I think that was about the time they started to come back in the general public too. Because that's when like all the low carb foods came around, and ketogenic, for whatever reason, like diet trends just shift and shift and shift. But that was also probably when some of the early research, modern research on ketogenic diets was starting to show up and be tested, right? And that would all lead to my first book, The Ketogenic Diet, which got me labeled as the keto guy, stupidly, because people still believe, oh, Lyle only advocates. No, go read that book. A, it's great for insomnia. It's terribly written. It's very boring. People tell me it's great, and I'm just convinced they've never read it and want to pretend. I'm not happy with it. Just the writing style. I mean, whatever. It was what it was. Nowhere in that book do I say you should do a ketogenic diet. Not once. Not once do I advocate it. I say, if you decided to do one, here's what you need to know. But people don't read. And what's hilarious is that two groups disliked me for that book. The keto zealots hated me because I didn't say the ketogenic diet was magic. And the anti-ketogenic zealots didn't like me because I didn't say it was poison. Because you cannot make anybody happy. Actually presenting a factual, evidence-based, nuanced examination of the topic, that the diet is this and is not that, pissed off both, because that's what always happens with cults. So they kind of came back in. And now, certainly, the athletic versions were very different than the epilepsy version. The biggest difference to me being, at least the way I recommended them, higher dietary protein intakes. Because that, beyond anything, is critical on a fat loss diet. And we weren't really doing ratios. Like, Dan was like, oh, it needs to be 75 fat, 25% protein. And I'm like, yeah, I don't like percentages in the first place. And when you set it up correctly with enough protein and set the calories right, it's closer to half and half, keep carbs low. And he had some things wrong in there about, you know, ketone metabolism. He's like, oh, you know, you will get more fat loss for the same deficit, which isn't really true. If anything, it's a little bit less, because actually energy expenditure is down because of a slightly lower thermic effect of food. There's no real ketone inefficiency. Not to mention that what happens in the short term with ketones being used by the muscle, even if there is an inefficiency, it goes away after about 2 weeks because skeletal muscle stops using ketones with its brain fuel and blah, 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 blah. You know, and I did the Body Opus diet, and I led to the Body Opus diaries, that led to my book, and that led to my career. So, I mean, by all means. But then ketogenic diets were also back in the general public nature. And again, that's when we got, like I said, low-carb jelly beans. There's all these Atkins-friendly foods. And then I think it's kind of when the net carb thing sort of started. So that was the ketogenic diet. Okay, but let's actually define what it is. In the strictest biological sense, first let's talk about what a ketone is. A ketone is a fractured fat. Okay, so when fats are released from the fat cell, right, fatty acids, they go to muscle, they can be burned for energy in the heart, burned for energy in most tissues, minus a few. The brain cannot use fatty acids. A couple of tissues can only use glucose. But if the liver is overwhelmed with fatty acids, it starts to produce ketones, which are acetone, acetoacetate, and beta-hydroxybutyrate. These are just simply a breakdown product of elevated fat metabolism. Because fat release is elevated under low carb conditions. Now, whether or not that causes more fat loss depends, but we'll come back to that in a second. Now, ketones are mainly released during starvation. Most of the studies on ketone metabolism was during starvation. Because during total starvation, long-term fasting, the body will break down a ton of body protein to make glucose, to fuel the brain, to fuel other tissues. If that were to continue, you would die very quickly. Ketones are produced to take over as a fuel source. Eventually, the brain, for about 3 weeks, will switch to using about 75% ketones. By reducing the glucose requirement, that reduces the protein breakdown requirement. Survival. Ketones are protein sparing, in essence. But they're only protein sparing when dietary protein intake is insufficient. They're a starvation fuel. Ketogenic diets mimic starvation. And they do that by being low in carbohydrates. Now, this is key because a lot of people think of a ketogenic diet as a high fat diet. And it can be, but it needn't be. You want to get really, really specific? A ketogenic diet would be defined as one that causes the body to produce ketones in the bloodstream above a certain concentration, like in the strictest sense. Now, fasting does that. It is technically ketogenic in nature. You will develop ketosis. Your body will shift to using ketones for fuel in tissues that can use it. A protein-sparing modified fast, like my RFL, Mike Has No Tan, on my website, it may develop ketosis. It gets a little more complicated as the protein thing, but you will see basically the same thing because of the lack of carbohydrates. But it is low in dietary fat, and this is important. A ketogenic diet that's higher in dietary fat will produce the same metabolic state. And I bring this up because there is this belief that the reason that ketogenic diets cause you to burn more fat is because of the high fat content, and that's absolutely wrong. It's the lack of carbohydrates. Dietary fat intake has a very small impact on the body's use of fat for fuel. Dietary carbohydrate intake controls it. If you eat a lot of carbs, you burn carbs for fuel. If you eat no carbs, your body has to shift to fat. Fasting, PSMF, and a ketogenic diet at any calorie level, the commonality is zero carbs or very low carbs. The dietary fat content has nothing to do with that. And quite in fact, the higher your dietary fat intake, the less fat you lose. Because fat balance will be low. This is where the ketogenic diet people go wrong. They'll go, on a ketogenic diet, fat oxidation goes up to 180 grams per day or whatever it is. Well, yeah, but if fat intake is 80 grams, your net is still negative 100. If your fat oxidation is, you know, whatever, well, those are bad numbers to use. But let's say it goes up to 100 a day and your fat intake's 60, well, your fat balance is 40. Say on a carb-based diet, you're burning 60 grams of fat a day and you're only eating 20. Net fat balance is 40. Just because you're burning more fat doesn't matter if you're eating more fat. It's the difference that generates fat loss. High carb diet, less fat burned, less fat eaten. The difference. Low carb diet, more fat burned, more fat eaten. Less fat eaten, more fat. But it's the deficit at the end of the day. So technically a ketogenic diet. Now, usually anything less than 100 grams of carbohydrates a day will develop ketosis to some degree or another. Usually in a clinical sense, they will say carbs need to be below 50 grams a day. And that may be true to develop high blood ketone concentrations. Atkins went 30. Now, some of that's practical, right? If I tell someone 50, they'll probably end up at 80. If you tell someone 30, they'll probably end up at 50. Some of it is just protecting people from the dumb zor by giving them an extreme. So yeah, and it worked. Now, since that time, since my book especially, you know, and you look at the studies, and under calorie-controlled conditions and protein-controlled conditions, there were no real differences in fat loss that were ever seen. Because there's not. Now, frequently in ad lib studies, they would see differences.
And by ad lib studies, you mean where people eat as much as they want?
Yeah, they go tell someone, all whenever right, you're on a low fat diet, you're on a low carb diet, eat, come tell us, let's see what happens. And yep, you will see the keto people.
Short for ad libism.
Yes, ad libism.
Yep.
You will see the keto people losing more fat. And you go look and like, but they're reporting eating the same number of calories. Yeah, and self-reporting is shit. We know factually that most people underestimate on a typical diet. And I suspect, and it's never been studied to my knowledge, people on a keto diet, they swear they're eating a ton. And you add it up, you're like, no, you're eating 1,600 calories. Like, no, no, no. Like, no, no, no. I'm like, add it up. I suspect that ketogenic dieters systematically overestimate calorie intake, and carb-based dieters systematically underestimate it. Not to mention that the keto people are invariably eating, like I said, 50% more protein. That's the difference. It's the protein intake. But the keto people can't seem to understand that you can eat higher protein on a carb-based diet. They don't seem to grasp that.
Mm.
But they are happy to use these uncontrolled diet studies and say, no, 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 these are more valid than metabolic work studies where everything is controlled. Okay, cool. Cool story, guys. Until the metabolic work studies that were funded by a ketogenic diet group showed, yeah, there's no benefit. That was a real kick in the nuts for them. That was a few years ago, Kevin Hall's work. So from a... assuming calories are controlled, assuming the same protein intake, there is no physiological fat loss benefit of the ketogenic diet by and large. So that brings up the question, well, why would you bother? Because it may have other potential benefits, and it may benefit certain populations more than others. And those people are the ones that have what we now call metabolic syndrome, what used to be called syndrome X, which is a cluster of things, including insulin resistance, all these sequelae that basically occur as a function of developing overweight and severe insulin resistance, where reducing carbohydrates, reducing glycemic load often has benefits, and it often does have health benefits, even in the absence of fat loss. Because obviously you've got a system of biology that's not tolerating carbs well. There is a logic to taking them out, right? And again, Atkins wasn't drilling a dry well when he said that correcting an imbalanced metabolism may require an imbalanced diet. Turns out that he kind of got it right for the wrong reason. So certainly for certain, and there's also been a ton of data that ketones may have neurological benefits, et cetera, for a number of conditions because of. And just as a random note, we're not going to have time to do it tonight, but it is interesting to me. There is limited data that ketogenic diets may help with bipolar. And what I find interesting is that most bipolar drugs start as epilepsy drugs. There is something neurologically, neurobiologically similar about epilepsy and bipolar that seems to be linked. I don't know what it is. Something to do with, like, I stopped caring about everything that was going on with the epilepsy treatment stuff because it's not my area of interest. But for a certain population who may be severely insulin resistant, who may be suffering from, I'm not going to say carbohydrate addiction because I don't think that's a thing, but for whom overconsuming carbohydrates is a problem, frequently having them in a dietary situation where those are off limits is beneficial. There's no doubt about that. Even when I did body opus so many years ago, the nature of me, whether it was psychologically, physiologically, not that there's a difference, I can do no carbs and I can do all the carbs. But at the time, moderate carbs was very difficult for me. Body opus, if it did nothing else, regardless of any other biological shenanigans, made it so that I could adhere to the low calorie days. Because I got to eat zero carbs. They weren't allowed. Fiber, some veggies. No starches were allowed. And then I got to eat all of them during the carb load.
It's a very bipolar diet, if you like. Well,
but it fit me in a way that, like, later in my life, I was able to do moderate carb diets. But at the time, it for me, was an adherence thing. And that is more important than all of this. We can theorize and argue and hypothesize and speculate about the optimal diet. And what it is. If we knew what the best diet was, we'd know by now, but we do know. Sustained deficit, sufficient protein, long-term adherence. The end. whatever happens to give that individual the best long-term adherence. For some, it will be keto. For some, it will not. For some, it will be TRE. For some, it will not. For some, it will be six meals a day. The studies have shown, and I was saying this back in the 90s, they go, what's the best diet? The one you can stick to. And now that's all the data shows. Whether it's keto, low carb, DASH, Mediterranean, over the long term, they all generate about the same long-term loss. It's all about adherence. For many people, keto is beneficial for adherence. For whatever reason, whether it's a bright line boundary, whether it's bracing classically conditioned eating behaviors. For some people, once they start eating carbs, they can't stop. Period. They have to be keto for life, and that's fine. I have no problem with that. Now, we don't have any long-term data. The epileptic kids, like 3 or 4 years, but whatever. I mean, we don't know. So there is a population, like it has been shown to have benefit in polycystic ovary syndrome, a condition that is marked by near universal insulin resistance. In that condition, there's almost no question that at least moderating carbs, and in some cases removing them completely, can have massive benefits. Now, by the same token, there is a group of people that on keto feel like warmed over horse crap, never adapt, feel terrible, can't train well. If you're training intensely, that brings in another variable. There is no universality in this regard, which of course all diet cultists forget, just like exercise selection. What's the best diet? The best, the one that I found worked for me. That's the best diet for everyone. No, you myopic dip. That's the one that happened to fit you, which is great. And I'm thrilled and I'm happy for anyone that's found the right diet for them. But to assume that that makes it universally the best is myopic stupidity. Now, what I found through just, I mean, because let's face it, I've been getting feedback on this thing since 96, whenever I wrote my first book, 98, something like that. I'm the go-to guy. And like, look, my book seriously is in like university bookshelves because it is a reference book on ketogenic diets. It'll never be written again, and I'm sure as hell not doing a second edition. No one else will ever write something like this. It is a tome. It's also a full training tome, but that's a whole separate thing. What I've found in general, people that do really well on high carbs, feel good, good energy, good muscle pumps, etc., feel terrible on ketogenic diets. They never adapt. They feel like run over, like they've been run over by a truck for 3 weeks. Because there's the keto flu, there's an adaptation period. Never, they hate it. People that feel terrible on high carbs, lots of blood sugar swings, poor appetite control, they get, you know, bloated, water. They do great on low carbs. They love keto. Their brains work better. There's certainly some neurochemistry to it in terms of dopamine, serotonin, all kinds of stuff. There's a middle group that seems to, doesn't matter. And I don't know what explains that. I can do it. I can shift back and forth now. I've been doing this. I've been playing around this stuff for 30 years. I can slip into ketosis like that and slip right back out of it and be fine. But that's after years of fooling around with this.
Yeah, I seem that's to recall it general, on your Facebook group. People shared anecdotes about how the first switch to keto was rough, but subsequent switches to keto weren't nearly as difficult.
That's purely anecdotal because it is, there's an enzymatic change. Like the brain does take a couple weeks to adapt to using ketones. And often people will feel kind of crappy with their brains not working well. But like I said, others feel great. A lot of it, that's electrolyte intake. If you keep sodium and potassium high, that fixes a lot of that. But it seems like once you've made, there seems to be a permanent shift that the body can shift back and forth more easily. It's purely anecdotal. It's purely experientially, but so many people have reported it, but it's never been studied to my knowledge. It's again, I am keto agnostic in the sense of it absolutely has appropriate uses. It absolutely is inappropriate in certain situations. If you're training intensely, you run into a whole separate set of issues because despite nonsensical claims to the contrary, you do require carbohydrates to sustain intense training. And despite Bart What's-His-Name's idiotic belief about it, a ketogenic diet cannot replace glycogen sufficiently by itself. Gluconeogenesis cannot get it done, Bart.
What if you were to consume a lot of protein? Like a lot.
It's so the early numbers, like back in the day, and this goes back to the ketogenic ratio, that supposedly up to 50% of protein could be turned into glucose. But when they've done the feeding studies, it doesn't work out that way. Just doesn't. They give 40 grams of protein and
Send me some of those papers so I can throw them up.
I looked them
screen.
Up because there was some nonsensical video and I went to the comments and was like, yeah, sorry, this is absolutely, it was one zealot criticizing Mike Isertel and they're both.
It was Bart K, right?
Yes, it was Bart K. And I go, sorry, dude. And then it was like, hey, maybe you should. And it was actually, if you read the comments, they were like, you know, y'all should really have Lyle McDonald on the show, someone who actually knows what he's talking about.
Yeah, it was on the Revival Fitness channel.
Yes, it was. And of course, I put up the studies. I said, look, there's a 1960 study. They glycogen depleted and they put them on a ketogenic diet. 6 days later, there was barely any glycogen repletion. It will not sustain performance, period. And the feeding studies are like, we gave 40 grams of radio-labeled protein, 4 grams of glucose. You could not provide enough to refill muscle glycogen for all but the lowest volumes of training. Period. But yeah. Hi, Bart. He thinks I'm an idiot because I think vegetables are healthy. So, cool story, bro. So yeah, like I said, I'm agnostic about it. It can have its role. There are places where it's absolutely the wrong choice. Used cyclically, like I said, I don't set up ketogenic diets either by the ketogenic ratio or by the even way Dan did it. This is not how I set up diets. Set calories, set protein, set the rest. Whatever fat comes out to is what it comes out to. There is no percentage, there is no ratio that is optimal because calories and protein matters more than the rest of it. And that's how I presented it in the book. I also presented just for people, you know, the training issue. Cyclical ketogenic diets were a way around that because you carb load to refill muscle glycogen. You know, Dan was approaching it from a different thing. We talked about that in the UD2. Thing with Larry, but there were people that needed to be keto, metabolic syndrome, syndrome X, type 2 diabetes, that for health reasons, but they needed to sustain high intensity training. So back in the 90s, we developed what we called the targeted ketogenic diet, which is simply keto, but you have carbs before and after training. Carbs before to get blood sugar up, support training, a little bit of carbs after, get sucked into the muscle, go back to keto for the rest of the day. So that's all in that book. Here's how you set up the optimal ketogenic diet for fat loss, right? Not epilepsy. Like I said, that's a different thing. Those are set up differently. If you need to perform intensive weight training, you can do cyclical, where you do the carb load, and here's how you should set it up, and here are the numbers, and here's how you train. Or you can do the targeted version if you prefer to stay keto most of the time and not carb load. And that was it. That was, you know, everything else was a lot of ketone physiology, a lot of data, like my books. Nearly that book never almost broke me.
I wanted to ask you what you think the most common mistakes are when people set up keto diets.
Too much dietary fat.
Right.
Well, and that comes out of another misunderstanding, which is that being in ketosis is important. Or more importantly, well, let me back up. So one of the things Atkins recommended, there are these things called ketone strips. And they're these little, you pee on them. And they turn purple. Now they're used by diabetics because type 1 diabetics can go into ketoacidosis where ketone concentrations get high. Non-diabetics there's at least 3 feedback loops that prevent that from occurring. When ketones hit a certain point, A, stimulates insulin release, which shuts down fat release. There are a couple others that basically serve as a block. Type 1 diabetics don't have that. They can go into ketoacidotic crisis. Watch any medical program, that'll be at least one episode, right? And they give them glucose because they start losing tons of electrolytes and they become acidotic. And so they have to. So diabetics would use those to check ketone levels. And so Atkins recommended that. The idea being, deeper ketosis means the diet's working better. But that's not true. If anything, it's the opposite. So, and the confusion came from the definition of ketosis. Ketosis is defined by blood concentration. Blood ketone concentration is above a certain level. By definition, the ketones you're losing in the urine are extra. You actually lose a little bit of ketones in the breath, like 2 calories a day. There's your metabolic advantage. You actually exhale. People get ketone breath, kind of an acidic, but you actually exhale ketones, and you can pee ketones out, but you're only peeing excess ketones. So if you're using them for energy, you won't. So the problem came if you're like, oh, I'm not showing any urinary ketones. I must not be in ketosis. No, you might be. We would need a blood test. Unfortunately, you cannot put a drop of blood on the ketone test. I know. I tried. Trust me, I experimented with all this stuff. I've done work. So you can't, it is an indirect measure of actually whether or not you're in ketosis. And yeah, okay, like I said, ketones are protein sparing if protein intake isn't sufficient. But if protein intake isn't sufficient, it doesn't matter. Ketones are not protein sparing. You don't lose more fat being in ketosis. Some people still try to argue that ketones are part of appetite suppression, which some people get on ketogenic diets. Probably more the dietary protein. I haven't really kept up with that. But being in deep ketosis per se doesn't really mean anything. The problem comes in. It goes back to that fat fast thing. It goes back to the idea that, oh, eating fat makes you burn fat. No, not unless you eat a ton of it. You eat like 100 grams of fat at once, you get a little bit of a bump in fat oxidation, but you store the rest of it. So eating less carbs make you burn more fat. So because of that, they're like, oh, well, I don't have urinary ketones. So I'm like, oh, you just eat a ton of dietary fat and then you'll be in deep ketosis. And that means you're losing weight. Nope, ketosis has nothing to do with it. You can lose fat and not be in ketosis. You can be in ketosis and not lose fat. Or sorry,
you can be in ketosis and gain weight.
Sure. Absolutely. Because all that matters is
tough to do, but it can be done.
Carb intake. It can be done, especially when you start doing fat bombs and deliberately eating. Like one of the Atkins treats, this is vile. You know what pork rind is?
Yeah.
Yeah. Pork rind dipped in cream cheese? Ugh. Sour cream? I knew a guy, a buddy, my training partner.
Oh, that's feral.
He would eat, you know what Slim Jim is?
No.
Slim Jim, it's beef jerky.
Oh, okay.
That's a brand of beef jerky that's very long and very thin. He would walk around with a jar of mayonnaise and Slim Jim.
Oh.
Vile. And unnecessary and actually unproductive. Because, again, even if fat oxidation goes up significantly, the more dietary fat you eat, your net fat balance can be zero or positive. It's easy. But yeah. It's not easy. You got to eat a ton, but it can be done. If you're burying everything in fat and drinking, like, it can be done, but it's difficult. So yeah, there is no correlation between ketosis in general and fat loss, or even the degree of, if anything, and this was, again, I just asked people, I'm like, all right, what is your experience then? If anything, most people found that deeper ketosis meant that they lost less fat, probably because it meant that because if you're eating less dietary fat, you're making slightly fewer ketones, which means they're being used for energy. Urinary ketones are the spillover. Again, that's anecdotal. It's never really been measured to see if the depth of ketosis, but there's no correlation whatsoever. So it's more that, does it help someone better adhere or control blood sugar? Again, if someone is pre-diabetic, type 2 diabetes syndrome, PCOS, whatever, severely insulin resistant, absolutely beneficial. No argument in my mind whatsoever. Possibly some benefits for neurological conditions. I think the data on that's a lot weaker and probably mostly animal work, but it may be doing something in the brain to stabilize whatever. People always ask me, oh, why aren't you on a ketogenic diet to help with your bipolar? I'm like, because I won't stick to it. And meds are easier. And I have no side effects from my meds. That's why. Because I'm not going to stick to a ketogenic diet long term. Period. So I don't care if it has any benefits.
Can we talk about ketogenic diets and athletic populations, like weight training individuals, or?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's been what the idea of using ketogenic diets for performance has been around forever. Now, mostly this
Some marathon runners, for instance, see benefits in going keto. Well, they claim to anyway.
They claim to is the key word here. So the idea, because you do see adaptations in skeletal muscle to ketogenic diets. As I refer to it, like a retooling, like change in mitochondria and the enzymes involved in fat oxidation and fatty acid transport proteins. There are all these adaptations. So in endurance performance, you get into this issue where, you know, the bonk, where you deplete muscle glycogen, you run out of carbs and performance craters. So the idea became, okay, if we can adapt athletes to using fat for fuel, that should spare glycogen so that they don't bonk as soon. So there were all these studies back, many of them are in my book, and there's been a ton since then. And they would do stuff like, okay, we're going to do keto for 5 days and then carb load for 2. And what they would see that was over 5 days, they would see a drastic increase in fat oxidation. And then they would try to carb load in hopes of, can we get the best of both worlds? Can we fat adapt and then carb load? So they've got fat for fuel for low intensity in the carbs. And actually, let's back up. One of the earliest studies on ketogenic diets and performance was done in the 70s by Stephen Finney. But it gets cited endlessly to this day. And I cited it. They took like 6 high-level cyclists, and they put them on a ketogenic diet for like a month or 6 weeks or something. And they tested time to exhaustion at a submaximal intensity. And what they found is that on average, time to exhaustion went up drastically and they were using more fat for fuel. Aha! Performance improves. Well, there's a couple problems here. One, if you look at the individual data, 2 subjects got this just massive improvement and the other 4 or worse on average. Maybe that was biological differences. There was some data in the 80s talking about a high and low fat phenotype. Maybe it fit their biology. But the thing is, time to exhaustion is not how sports are run. Time to exhaustion tests, we're going to put you in a given intensity and let you ride until you stop. No race is run like that. Competitions are who can cover a fixed distance the fastest, not who can go the longest at a submaximal intensity. So it's not a ecologically valid study. And then there was another one in untrained individuals. Also, the subjects reported that their training quality was crap. They couldn't maintain their high intensity workout. Their performance was trash. Their training was impaired. And even before that, they had done the early carb load studies. They would do 3 days of a high-fat, low-carb diet with glycogen-depleting exercise, followed by 3 days of high carb. Like, that's the early carb load stuff in the 70s. And yeah, it worked, but all the athletes were like, yeah, we felt like warmed over crap for 3 days, trying to do exhaustive training on low carbs. And then there was a study in like untrained, overweight beginners that improved performance at a low intensity. Well, yeah. Fat can support low intensity activity. All right, so back to the modern era. So they did all these studies. 5-2 were the early ones. And what they kind of found was like, okay, there's a fat adaptation, but it doesn't seem to really be translating into improved performance. If anything, it harmed high intensity performance. Because that's the other thing. Most sports, again, they're not going to low intensity for as long as possible. They're usually not high intensity the whole time. They're low intensity for most of it, and then you have to go hard and fast, up a hill, catch a sprint, in a break, or whatever. So they started to do the studies like, well, let's test their high intensity performance after fat adaptation, and it was worse. And it had to do with adaptations in pyruvate dehydrogenase within the muscle. That is involved. There was a change in isoform from the one. They wanted fat adaptation to be carbohydrate sparing, But what it was carbohydrate impairing, because the body lost the ability to use carbs when it mattered. And in elite sport, cycling, marathoning, anything that has a high intensity event, that's not good. And they did dozens of studies. They did one in race walkers, which race walking.
I have a mutual friend who's an Olympic
race walker.
Yeah. She's in med school.
I mean, it's amazing. Crazy. Those guys can go 5 miles an hour walking, but goofy as hell. They did one in that, and they were like, yeah, they fat adapted and they use more fat for fuel, but impaired their exercise efficiency. There's dozens of studies. Someone collated it once. There is literally, most studies show no benefit or no effect either direction. Some studies show an impairment of performance, and literally zero studies show a performance benefit. We're talking 30 years of research. It's never improved anything. At best, it does no harm. At worst, it harms high intensity performance. There is like no question about this in the mind. Now, yeah, a bunch of also ran 4-hour marathoners. Sure. Fantastic stuff. Do keto. All the best. There's a reason that the Kenyans eat a 70% carb diet. And it's because, carbs provide ATP more efficiently for high intensity activity, period. Now, what is interesting about the way the Kenyans do it, they do typically do a fasted run in the morning, followed by a second run 4 hours later, followed by a fed high intensity run later. There is some interest in training under low glycogen conditions from time to time. So rather than being keto, like you might do a hard workout in the morning, and then, or like you might do your training in the evening and not eat carbs. So like the morning workout is done under low glycogen conditions, which is most of what's going on more than the diet itself. And then you eat so that you can support high intensity training to try to get a little bit of the best of both worlds. But no study has ever shown that like a strict ketogenic diet or even fat adaptation followed by carb load improves performance. Not a one. Now, what about weight training? There have been a couple studies that people love to cite that don't. Carbohydrate intake doesn't seem to impact weight room performance. I'm sure Bart K has him right at the top of his mind.
Oh, darling, did you miss me? I certainly missed you. I can't help myself.
And then you go read him, and it's all like, yeah, we put them on a low carb diet, and they did like 2 sets, and it didn't hurt their performance. Yeah, well, no shit. An Italian researcher named Paoli has suggested this frequently for like body weight. Sports like gymnastics and stuff. And it's like, dude, you do realize that ketogenic diets cause dehydrations and are going to cause people to get joint injuries, right? And he doesn't. I got a big flame war with him. I sent him a copy of my book. I don't think he read it because he was making a bunch of nonsense quotes. So, yeah, probably doing a couple sets, probably. If you're doing any sort of like real training, no. They've done that, right? I think there was a study that looked at like a ketogenic diet versus a carb-based diet. Is it like trained younger individuals? And they were like, well, the carb-based diet was better, caused more muscle gain, but the ketogenic diet caused less muscle gain, but more fat loss. Well, yeah, because they spontaneously ate less. There's been some intermittent fasting. There's time-restricted TRE studies that have found the same thing. They're like, oh, the TRE group spontaneously lost fat. Well, yeah, because the TRE made them eat less. So it's kind of a...
By TRE, you mean time-restricted eating, just in case. Because this may be a separate segment entirely. Clarified that, like,
yes, well, it used to be called intermittent fasting, time-restricted eating, and eating window around training. So, like, that is the big confound. But, yeah, if you're doing super low-volume training, you might get away with it. But any decent, and that's what they've done in all those studies that conclude, oh yeah, you know, daily carbohydrate intake within a certain range doesn't impact weight room performance. But they're like, we tested one RM. Yeah, no shit. Like, yeah, you tested a max single. Of course it didn't have an impact. Now do a high volume weight room workout, see what happens. So yeah, I don't see any real benefit of it from a performance standpoint. You know, it with modifications, it can be used for fat loss. I mean, some of the stuff we talked about in the RFL podcast, some of these alternate day fasting, are essentially a type of modified. Because like I said, RFL can develop ketosis. The protein probably prevents it, but it is a very low carbohydrate diet. And you are alternating that on your diet days with higher carb calorie days on your training days. That is essentially a modified version of it, but running straight keto without either a carb load. So if volume is super low, I mean, strict RFL does that, right? It's full RFL, and you're doing two very low volume weight room workouts because you're not, it's going to take you weeks to deplete glycogen under those conditions. And by the time you need it, you can do a maintenance day or refeed or whatever. So, but and it's funny, like whenever I would get it, you know, the people that are determined to prove, like, there's a guy in my group years ago, an old buddy of mine, and he was like, well, I knew this guy, it was some 24-hour running race thing. I'm like, yeah, it'll absolutely support piss-ass intensity activity. Or he was like, yeah, and he did a 1RM every hour for 25. Who gives a crap? Let's talk about real sports, right? Yes, absolutely, keto will support piss-ass intensity workout. I'm sure it would support ultramarathons, just great. There's actually part of the reason women are often do better at ultramarathons. They use more fat for fuel. I made this joke, so it's not a joke. A dude keto adapting for an ultramarathon is essentially trying to make his physiology more like a woman's. So, not a joke. Trying to improve his ability to use fat for fuel because men run out of carbs sooner and they bomb, even at those piss-ass intensities. But I would never recommend it from a performance standpoint. I see no benefit to it.
We've covered performance, and outside of particular medical concerns like PCOS, metabolic syndrome, epilepsy, do you reckon there are any good reasons to use a ketogenic diet instead of a high protein diet, say, where you just don't pay close attention to the carb fat ratio?
Only if it, Yeah, if for someone setting a strong carb limit, right? It's like, because the potential issue with some moderate carb diets, depending on, and it depends on the person. Some people find that if they get that first taste of a bread or a starch or whatever, they will lose food control. It's just that simple. Keto acts as a bright line boundary on the foods most people tend to have problems with. You simply cannot eat them. You cannot eat bread. You cannot eat starches. You cannot eat all the fun stuff. You can eat vegetables. That's it. Under the strictest form of the diet. If that helps someone adhere. And for many, it does. And there's other potential benefits. I would have to give you a 4-hour lecture on classical and Skinnerian conditioning to explain it. The long and the short of it is that much of our eating is nothing more than Pavlovian cue conditioning. We see a food trigger. And we eat it. Well, if that food is off limits on that diet, not only do we not eat it, but it ends up weakening that conditioned cue over time. So for many people who cannot eat moderate carbs, now some amount of time on whether it's keto, any strict diet, RFL does it. There's been studies using like total liquid low carb diet, any bland diet that eliminates those foods, it can weaken those cue conditions. So, and there is kind of a paper worth talking about. They took two groups, and this actually ties back into something Atkins said, that again, he was right for kind of the wrong reason. So what they did in this paper was they took two groups and put them on ketogenic diet for some amount of time. I don't know, 8 weeks, I want to say. Don't swear me to that. And then after that, they said, okay, but some of them did start to report carb cravings. And that's usually, oh, you're just going to crave, blah, 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 ketogenic diet just cause cravings. Well, actually, that's the opposite is true. Actually, when you stay on a diet for long enough without craved foods, your cravings go down. And literally every piece of literature says that, so get bent. But whatever. Whatever. They said one group, they said, you can now start adding carbohydrates back at your own personal sort of preference. And comfortability, which is a word now. And most of them, by the time all was said and done, they end up at about 150 grams a day. Nice moderate amount. because they had spent enough time. Taste buds take a good 4 to 6 weeks to change. We know this occurs. These conditioned cues take a good 6 to 8 weeks to change, so that frequently foods you could not eat in moderation before, you may be able to eat in moderation later. Now, we go back to Atkins' original book. And what he said, he did offer a bit of an exit strategy. He said, okay, once you reach your goal, you can stay basically on this diet, but you can start to bring carbohydrates back in. Now, he said, to the point you stop losing weight, and he called it the critical carbohydrate limit, the CCL. And it was about 150 grams a day. So I find it, like I said, he was kind of right for the wrong reason, but he wasn't drilling a dry well, which is that, and we also know with weight loss, with fat loss, insulin resistance improves, there's changes in the reward system. Again, they didn't know anything about that in the 70s. Now we know that there are long-term adaptations, behaviorally, psychologically, physiologically, neurobiologically, that occur in response to long-term dieting that can change this dysregulated system and make it such that down the road. There's also something I saw in a paper one time, and this gets missed by everyone, and I would never be able to find it again. But it made this very simple point. It was talking about diet in terms of weight loss. It said there is no fundamental reason that the same diet you lost weight on is the one you must maintain on. And how that concept has such a simple concept. You know, like, well, you can't stay on keto forever. Well, A, yeah, some people absolutely do, so clearly you're wrong. But B, who says you have to? If keto facilitates you getting to this goal and then you are able to transition out of it into something more moderated, what's the problem, right? No diet is fundamentally sustainable forever in terms of its deficit. Eventually, you will be adding other foods by definition at maintenance. What's added will depend. For some people, starches may be off limits forever. I've consulted with people who are just like, nope, part of it works for me, or keto works for me. If I eat bread, I'm done. I'm like, cool, fine. Just raise your dietary fat. Those are your high calorie days. I give a shit. His weight training volume is low enough. I'm like, I don't care. Whatever lets you stick to it. I don't give a damn. Other people are able to bring back in and work at moderate carbs. Some people can eat some foods and not others. Some people find they can bring in fruits, but not starches. I give a damn, fundamentally. Right? If they're like, I weight train high volume, we're going to have a different discussion. But if you're not the general person lifting a couple times a week, not doing high volumes, who's, how many effing carbs do they need a day? And the answer is not many. Right? When you math out rational fat loss diets or rational maintenance diets at appropriate calorie levels and appropriate protein levels, you end up with carbs at about 1 to 1.5 grams per pound, 2.2 to 3.3 grams per kilo. That's enough. Moderate dietary fat at, you know, 0.5 gram per pound, 1 gram per kilo. Protein, that's about where it comes out without fail, if you map it out rationally. If activity is high, carb intake goes up because calories are like that. It will scale upward, right? Because the way I set up diets, you set calories, you set protein. Typically, I set fat, and then carbs are the rest. Well, if activity, if energy expenditure is going up, your carbs go up by definition. Someone who's training hard 2 hours a day, yeah, they may be at 6.6 grams per kilo because their activity is higher. Someone who's sedentary lifting a couple times a week, they'll be at half that. And that's plenty. How many carbs does the average person need? Sure as hell not 10 to 12 grams per kilo like they used to recommend to the endurance athletes. So yeah. There are cases, like I said, it's a matter of, and again, as long as it's deficit in the protein, I give a crap. Carbohydrates and fats are totally negotiable to me. On a day, again, outside of specific contexts. And that's always intensive training.
How about?
Not always. Like, it is predominantly intensive training.
Sure.
Every once in a while, did one consult. Guy's like, I'm a physician. I'm on my feet 8 hours. I find that my brain starts to fall out about 4 hours in. I go, fine. What have you found that works? He's like, well, I have some fruit midday, some protein. I go, fine. Do you have to be at 30 grams or less? No, I don't care. I don't want you passing out at work, right? Like that's, he's in a very mentally exhausting, intensive thing, and that uses up a lot of brain glucose. That's why you feel like you pulled a lobe when you take a standardized test. You use up all your brain carbs. There is. Brain has muscle glycogen, or brain glycogen, or the glycogen stored in the brain. It can get depleted. So yeah, intensive training is where usually the modifications have to be made. But usually, by definition, anyone who's intensively training is probably not severely insulin resistant. They may still have eating habit issues, but you just have to make modifications. Whether it's putting carbs only around training or doing a carb load once a week or whatever to support training. But other than that, for most people, again, how many carbs do they need? The answer is not many.
Thank you for that. Are the electrolytes, not as many as they think, potentially a concern on a keto diet?
Yeah,
in a way, well, that they aren't. Because, yes, you know, and sodium, yes, potassium, so, magnesium, calcium.
Yeah. So yes and no. So early studies showed that ketogenic diets could be nutritionally adequate. Like there were no major nutrient deficiencies. There's an old paper from the 1920s, one of the first, the keto people always pulled this up. And it was two explorers who lived on basically a low carb diet for a year with no.
Were they Inuits?
No, this was American explorers.
Right.
And the biomedical library in Tennessee that I went to had it. So I read it.
Cool.
Because of course I have. I went nuts on that book the way I always go nuts. I had to read every paper ever written ever. The full paper. And I did. Every single one of them, including that one. I pulled a 1920s paper on that. But one thing that is known is when you reduce carbs, there is a diuresis, lowered insulin, which causes absorption at the kidneys, and you do lose electrolytes, sodium, potassium, magnesium. Those need to be replaced. Now, if you are eating food, you will be getting some. This was the problem with the last chance diet. It was based around
no electrolytes.
Liquid collagen. It was liquid collagen. It was also a zero biological value protein.
Yeah.
Right? That was the other big problem.
Double
the
whammy.
The body was still, yeah. And you couldn't, if you sat down to try to come up with the worst diet, the most pathological diet you want, you could, I don't think you could dream that up. It was truly the perfect storm of the worst possible combination of things. Whole foods will provide some amount of sodium and potassium, and probably that, depending on what you're eating. But it is generally accepted that you need to add more on a very low carbohydrate diet. And the typical numbers, this is additional. This is where people get a little bit confused. Maybe I wasn't clear enough in the book, right? It's not daily totals. You need to add 3 to 5 grams of sodium and at least 1 gram of potassium. 4 milligrams of magnesium is enough. Since there's not a lot of dairy foods, you probably want a calcium supplement. That's more from, but I mean, you'll get some calcium, just depending on what you eat. But
sure.
Doing that.
Having whey powder, maybe not whey casein.
Yeah, if you're getting some sort of dairy protein, you'll be getting some. But in the study, they'll just use shit like bouillon, broth, things of that nature that are just high in sodium, or you could just add it. And that goes a long way. There's sort of this, they call it the keto flu. There could be a mental fatigue that occurs in the first couple of weeks as you, and I always kind of thought it was used the brain adapting to ketones, but keeping electrolytes up goes a massive way in preventing that.
The keto flu.
Yeah. It's just a general sense of malaise.
I'm glad we finally touched on this.
Yeah. So yeah, 3 to 5 grams of additional sodium, 1 gram of additional potassium. What I tell people, get light salt or low salt, that half and half, the 3366 sodium potassium chloride, and just salt the crap out of everything. Just use it more than liberally. Just salt the crap out. Or have some broth or bouillon or whatever. Just, you got to get that sodium potassium in there. So just, I put that stuff, when I'm doing my RFL days, I salt the crap out of everything. And it goes a long way.
Yeah, good stuff.
Something else. But
you'll want magnesium supplementation on top of that.
I mean, yeah, it's like you only need like 400 milligrams. It might help you sleep a lot. It doesn't take much. Most of the loss is through the urine or sodium, potassium, is what I recall. One thing that's interesting, many people feel positively euphoric in ketosis.
Yeah, the mental clarity thing. Is that just like the caffeine plus novelty or is something deeper going on?
So A, like I said, there is this weirdness. There are some neurological effects of ketones. And there is this old paper. There's this bizarre journal called Medical Hypotheses. And they will publish literally anything. If you can, any idea you can come up with, as long as you can half support it, they will publish it. As an example, I give you possibly one of the greatest theory papers I have ever read. Without naming names, it argued that one particular elite cyclist was as elite as he was due to the loss of one of his testicles. I kid you not. I will look up the title of the paper because it's amazing.
Was he like taking testosterone? Because that would at least explain it.
It is titled Metabolic Clues Regarding the Enhanced Performance of Elite Endurance Athletes from Orchiectomy Induced Hormonal Changes. They are talking about Lance Armstrong. And they came up with this bizarre, just amazing hypothesis about some supposed downstream hormonal effects of having one of your balls removed. It is, Medical Hypothesis will publish fucking anything. It's an amazing journal. Anyway, they published a paper suggesting that during certain types of transcendental meditation, there was enhanced uptake of ketones into the brain. And that explained the euphoria.
What do you make of that hypothesis?
I don't know. I haven't. It's been Andrew J. Brown, 2007. Low-carb diets, fasting, and euphoria. Is there a link between ketosis and gamma-hydroxybutyrate? Oh, GHB, even better. Because beta-hydroxybutyrate is a ketone.
Big Lenny's favorite.
Yeah. So, phenomenal stuff. I haven't read, like I said, I did not keep up with the neurological stuff. It started to come, it just wasn't my interest any more than the medical stuff. I cared about it from a fat loss standpoint. So there's something going on. There's no doubt. I think with the epilepsy bipolar, I think it's thought that it's like, because I think epilepsy is what's occurring, right? It's like there is a dysregulation of the electrical signals in the brain. Somehow ketones are stabilizing that. It may be that, you know, like I said, they've looked at it. It's all a lot of animal research. Alzheimer's, dementia, things of that nature could be something about ketones. I don't know. Free radicals. Who the hell knows? I don't care because I don't care. It's just not my area any more than I care about the impact of fasting on autophagy and mitophagy. Maybe it happens. Maybe it doesn't. I don't give a crap. I give a crap about fat loss and athletic performance. So if it happens, great. If not, great. I don't give a crap. I seriously don't care. So, but there is something wrong. So yeah, some people, who knows? Maybe it's because under carb-based diets, their blood sugar is up and down and up and down, and that causes energy swings. And in ketosis, blood sugar stabilizes, or the brain switches to ketones, or who knows? Maybe it's eating more protein. I don't, and that's impacting neurochemistry. Who the hell knows? It's one of those things that if it happens, great. If it doesn't, so be it. It's not universal. It simply is.
And in your five centuries in the fitness industry, have you ever met anyone who has managed to stay on the keto diet really long term, like 5+ years?
I don't know if in the fitness industry, I think absolutely you can find them in certain groups of dieters. Because I mean the fitness industry is as prone to fad following as anything. You know, we went super low fat in the 80s. And then, I mean, what's interesting is these ideas have really kind of been around, right? Garanda had his defo diet, and it was just a low carb diet that had the one carb, and it had one carb meal every fourth day. It was like
a 30 eggs a day thing.
Yeah, it was like you look at it and you're like, all right, breakfast, like flank steak and as many eggs as you want, but there's a limit to how much food you can eat. And I'm sure if you added it up with the people, the bigger guys were actually eating, they were in a deficit. It was just that simple. And 33-33-33 nutrition, where they even split between protein, carbs, and fats, that's been around for decades. I forget the guy's name off the top of my head.
Is the missing one for alcohol?
Yeah, well, 33 repeating.
I know.
I don't remember what the guy's name. I've got his book somewhere. And you know, like, again, I think for most people, then the zone was 30-40-30. Even Duchesne and Body Opus presented actually three diets: high carb, low fat, the typical contest prep approach, his what he called the isocaloric diet, which is 33-33-33, and then Body Opus, which is a cyclical ketogenic diet. It's kind of stepping down. And like for most people, like if you were gonna pin me down, I know this is not what you asked me, but is it ever? Like if I was gonna say for like the broadest number of applications, I don't like percentages for a bunch of reasons that I won't. I think it's a dumb way to set up diets because percentages have nothing to do with what your body needs. But ignoring that, if I was going to pick what I felt was the most broadly applicable macronutrient split, it would be closer to 30-40-30-30 isocaloric than not. Again, if you look at the way I math out diets, whether they're for fat loss or maintenance, it's closer to that than not. It's
like probably 30 protein, 40 carb, 30 fat?
Yeah, something, you know, or it's probably because I set protein intakes a little bit higher. It's probably closer to 40%, you know, 35, 30, 40, 30, 25. Like it's in that range. Most people just don't need a 60% carb diet. They don't need that many carbs because they're not doing the training. For most people, ketogenic might not, like, again, general, if I was just giving a general recommendation, because the way I set up diets is you set calories, set protein at sufficient amounts, and it'll always be 30 to 40%, almost without fail. It'll probably be 30% on higher calories and closer to 40 on lower calories. So the way it maths out, right? If you're doing, I mean, the math is easy. If you're doing 1 gram per pound of protein, that's 4 calories per pound. If you're dieting on 12 calories per pound, that's 33%. Oh, yeah. You go to 1.5 grams per pound, that's 6 calories per pound of protein. You're on 12 calories per pound on your diet, it's 50%.
Yeah, right
there in that range. So carbs usually end up similarly, right? What did I say? About 1 gram, 1.5 grams per pound, 2.2 to 3.3 grams per kilo. Same thing. Oh, it's about 4 to 6 calories per pound of carbs. It's going to end up in the same place. Fat, I usually set, you know, similar. So like, yeah, it's going to be in that range. Most people would do better with higher protein, moderate fat, moderate carb than any other combination. And that's all been around. Just like, so in the fitness industry, I don't think you'll find anyone that's stuck to any diet long-term because right now everyone's on the sugar diet because of fibroblast growth factor 21 and all this other low protein. I mean, I just want to go on record. In the late 90s, and I was trying to make a point, I wasn't recommending this, I said assuming you could adhere to it, you'd get ripped on table sugar and protein powder. It was like, but no, but the insulin's the glycemic index. I go, no, a table sugar has a lower glycemic index than potatoes, so if you get ripped on baked on potatoes, you can get ripped on table sugar.
Seriously?
Oh yeah, because the glycemic index of table sugar is the average of sucrose and fructose. So the fructose brings it down. Glycemic index of potatoes is way higher than table sugar.
Huh?
Go look it up. It's like 80 versus 60. And I'm like, you can get ripped on white rice or baked potatoes. You can get ripped on table sugar.
Like per calorie, the glycemic index is higher.
Well, glycemic, no. I mean, look, they use fixed amounts of carbohydrates.
Right. Okay, well, if it's a fixed amount of carbohydrates, then I guess that makes sense.
I mean, the glycemic load is more accurate, but it's the same as the way that they calculate that. Without getting off topic on that, that's a whole separate thing. Why glycemic index is stupid and glycemic load is more valuable and why it all kind of doesn't matter. But I was making a point of principle. The deficit and protein is all that matters. I wasn't recommending it. I was trying to make a point by example. And now here we are, 30 years later, people are following the effing sugar diet. Okay, cool story. We're not getting into that. So,
yeah, no.
I mean, whatever. If it's a deficit, enough pride, I don't give it. It'll work. It's stupid, but it'll work. So same thing here. So yeah, I mean, that's the ketogenic diet, you know, in a nutshell. I don't care about the ketogenic ratio. I don't care about fat to protein ratios. I care about the deficit, sufficient protein. Now, the way I do set up ketogenic diets is actually a little bit different than the way I set up carb-based diets. So I set up carb-based diets, calories, protein. I usually set dietary fat next so it doesn't go too low.
Yep, fair enough.
Carbs, just carbs the remainder.
Yep.
Carbs are whatever's left. Subtract protein. And then you may do a little bit of manipulation. Like if carbs are too low, you can futz around with carbs and fats a little bit. But I don't want fat. If you set carb intake too high right off the bat, fat intake may go too low. So you might have to adjust it. For a ketogenic diet, I do it the other way around. Set calories, set protein, set carbs at 50 or less or 30 or less, whatever it is.
Does it depend on like body weight?
No. Actually, no. So actually, we should have addressed this before. Where does this 100 value come from? And basically, the brain under normal conditions uses about 100 to 120 grams of glucose per day. And this is irrespective of body size, because brain size does not vary significantly between two individuals. Unless
you don't know my brain size's work ethic, Lyle.
I was going to say, let's just leave that one right there. So when you get below the brain's need for carbohydrates, that's when the body has to shift to ketosis. So this is one of those places. It is actually an absolute number. So studies, they'll say 50, Atkins used 30, whatever. It's impossible to get truly zero for the most part. Well, if you did carnivore, you could do it. But even vegetables will give you a little bit. So whatever. So again, calories, protein, set carbs at 30, subtract out that 120 calories, the rest is fat. And what you find in practice is that it's about 50-50. I mean, where's my checker there? Okay, let's see. We got someone at 150 pounds, 12 calories per pound. They are on 175 grams of protein, 4 times minus. They got 120 calories minus, that leaves 900, about 9. Yeah. So I come up with 150 pound person, 12 calories a pound, 175 grams of protein, about 110 grams of fat, which is a lot. Trust me, it's a lot. Yeah, that's a lot of dietary fat. And if you take it lower.
I had that much like yesterday.
Well,
I'm a big boy though.
Yeah, you can take it low. Well, yeah, I mean, that's just it. It's scale. I mean, that will scale with calorie intake.
Yeah.
So, and you, what do you weigh? 90 kilos?
Oh, 75 at the moment. Okay. Not very big, actually.
Yeah.
But yeah, like 2,700 calories is how much I have each day. So,
I mean, whatever, that's 30%, 33%, 3-3 repeating.
Yeah. It was a little higher in fat that day.
Yeah, but whatever, but like, and I tell people this all the time, like, again, unless you were dealing with very specific nutrient, like if carbs are a little bit higher on one day, a little bit lower on the next, within reason, who cares? It just doesn't make a difference in the big picture under, again, all but the most absolutely extreme conditions. And the grand majority of people are not in those extreme conditions where, you know, 25, 30 grams either way on any given day matters. So, I would only note, just again, this is one more thing, not that I think people are using this to set up ketogenic diets. I've occasionally seen this weirdness where people try to be on that cusp. There's this weird carbohydrate intake level at like right at the 100, 120 gram level. Like you sometimes get these weird low cal, these diets. People on poverty calories, protein is high, fat's a certain level, and the carbs are like right about that 100, 120 cutoff.
Mm.
And they feel worse than if they were either higher or lower.
Interesting.
It's like, it's just, this is totally just self-reported. What I think is happening, they've got just enough carbs to avoid developing ketosis to where they might make that shift.
Yeah.
But not quite enough to support everything optimally. That's my best.
Yeah. Do you reckon that like, same phenomenon happens with people who yo-yo, like they're on keto, off keto, like cyclical
can,
kind of thing?
It can. Like, and that, you know, like, and there was, like, back in the day, you know, the first few weeks, I think that's part of why a lot of us who did body opus felt worse.
Right.
Be,
yeah.
You know, like right about the time day five, that we're probably going to start getting into that rhythm and shifting to, we'd bop out of ketosis again and have to go through. Like there was, some people suggest, I don't think it was me, but there was some logic to like, you know what, you're probably better off doing straight ketogenic for 2 weeks and then bringing in the carb loads. But that's not how body opus was structured. But this is more on a day-to-day thing. Like, take them to 80 and they feel fine. Take them to 150, they feel fine. They're just in this terrible gray area where nothing works right.
And yeah.
They're better off.
Am I in keto? Am I not? Body doesn't know.
Yeah. Because other tissues in the body do use glucose. Most can shift to fat. There are a few, including the kidney, the retina. Also, the immune system uses glucose. They do require glucose. Now, the body can make that out of other stuff. Amino acids, lactate, and glycerol. But it cannot make enough to fuel other things. That's why the brain has to shift to ketones to spare glucose. It has to. But there's just this, again, purely anecdotal, where, and it's never someone like going, oh, I want to be on a ketogenic diet, but eat 120. Just their diet puts them there. And they feel worse than it if they adjusted it in one direction or another.
Yeah, right.
Slightly. So, you know, I'm like, all right, fine. Take out 30 grams of, or take out 10 grams of fat so we can add 30 grams of carbs, or take out 30 grams of carbs and add 10 grams of fat to keep the calories the same.
Yeah. So maybe cyclical ketogenic diets are inadvisable unless you're careful with how you set them up.
We're talking about slightly different things. What I'm saying with a cyclical ketogenic, it's not a matter of that, because on a cyclical ketogenic, the ketogenic diet will always be ketogenic. It will be below 50 or 30.
Oh, I see.
What I'm saying is that on a daily basis, if you end up at 120 grams of carbs a day, you may feel worse than if you were at 150 or truly ketogenic. Talking about a singular day, but there is some logic for some people to jump into a cyclical ketogenic diet. But again, I think like the way RFL set up is with the higher protein, I'm not even sure ketosis is developing to any significant degree.
Mm.
But it may be. But people seem, you know, yeah, maybe do 2 weeks of straight low carbs. Or, I mean, that's part of why I introduced that transition phase. I think one of the reasons body opus wrecked people, we were all coming out of high carb, low fat diets. And that is quite the transition. Right.
Yeah.
You go from high carbs to none overnight is disastrous. And, you know, and that's why like the UD2 appendix that I wrote many years later, and I'm like, look, you need to do a 2 week break in phase where you moderate carbs, bring them down to like a gram and a half, you know, 3.3 grams per kilo, bring them down.
Yeah.
To start getting used to that and retool, while also you need to get used to the depletion work, because jumping into that right out of the gate wrecked people. If they'd only been doing like heavier, lower repetition work, oh, the depletion workouts destroyed people the first couple of weeks. So I'm like, nah, we're gonna do a 2 week break in phase. Or we're gonna moderate carbs, give you a chance to adjust. So we did it the hard way. Because kids today are soft. Back in my day, we walked 10 miles uphill both ways. That's about 14 kilometers, kids. in the snow both ways just to get a bag of bagels. And we were happy. No, we weren't. But anyway, so yeah, those are some other considerations. But again, right. We also didn't really emphasize the sodium potassium. That might have fixed it. Don't really know in hindsight.
And I know you hate such questions, but what do you reckon a well-thought-out day of eating might look like on a keto diet?
Oh, God, I'm so bad at this.
I'm sorry. But people find this really helpful in all things.
I know, but I'm just not a meal plan guy. I don't think in those terms. I really do just make modular meals, and I haven't done a true keto diet in the longest time. But it is interesting. Lately, there has been research that is differentiating what they call a healthy ketogenic diet versus presumably an unhealthy. Because a lot of ketogenic diets, they're extremely high in saturated fats.
Yeah.
Very low in vegetables, phytonutrients, very low in... So there, it's essentially a Mediterranean ketogenic diet. I've also seen very low carb Mediterranean diet thrown around. Mm. In the sense that they are more emphasizing leaner proteins, more oleic acid, more olive oil, more polyunsaturates, rather than, you know, the saturated fat bombs, you know, where the typical keto diet might be, you know, eggs cooked in butter with some sausage. I mean, oh my God, I used every day at lunch when I was first fighting body opus, my coworkers hated me for this. Canned pink salmon with mayonnaise.
Uh-huh.
Oh, it smelled so bad. I can't smell it anymore. It is the worst. It is absolutely the worst.
My condolences.
Then I would do we've got these things called cheese sticks or string cheese over here. They're great because if you microwave them, you can almost pretend it tastes like pizza, with a little tomato sauce on it. And then the gross dessert I would have, protein powder with stevia, and you use heavy cream. Because at this point, I hadn't really looked into it. I was like, I was trying to keep
my made like a chocolate mousse.
Yeah, it was actually pretty good. But in hindsight, it was way too much dietary fat.
Yeah.
Because at the time, Dan was like, 75-25%. I was trying to hit certain, I would never do that now. But I don't even, I tend to either just do RFL or high carb days. I don't really do true keto. I haven't done a real ketogenic diet in the longest time. But it would be along those lines. You know, in terms of what do most people eat for breakfast? It would probably be, scrambled eggs of some sort, possibly with cheese, cooked in butter, maybe with some side meat, I guess. I don't know. Seriously, ask somebody. I'm not the guy to ask. I mean, dinner might be a fattier steak with salad. That's easy, right? For lunch, it would be chicken. You could have salad and put olive oil on it. That would be the healthier version of it, right? You're not going to deep fried, or you might eat, I would eat skinless chicken, but you could eat skin chicken or chicken thigh that has, higher fat content, some of the fattier fishes. But I don't know. Because I haven't done it, and I don't do meal plans. I don't do that.
Yeah,
I'm just like, here are the numbers, figure it out.
Highlighted how there are healthy and unhealthy
relatively
diets, and
they're relatively better.
Yeah, relatively speaking, of course. And obviously, my buddy Vegan Gains will be able to attest to this. There are really, really bad ways to do the vegan diet, and there are obviously. I would even go as far as to say good, healthy ways.
So I Googled up healthy ketogenic diet, fats, avocado oil, coconut, olive oil, butter, ghee, nuts, seeds, fatty fish, proteins, meat, fish, eggs, and cheese, low carb vegetables. I mean, duh. I don't even see how that's, Oh, then we've got clean keto, grass fed meats, wild caught seafood, and organic produce for the nutritionally privileged. So yeah, like I said, it's kind of it's just a matter of you can load up on all the saturated fat in the world, or, you can choose lower fat proteins and add dietary fat to it from healthier sources, depending on your beliefs about that.
Big picture. You heard the term Oreo vegan? vegans who eat nothing but Oreos and drink fruit juice. Like, that's a vegan diet, technically speaking, but exceedingly unhealthy.
I knew those people in college that are like, oh, they would live on, you know, snack chips and nothing and go, well, I'm vegan. I'm like, yeah, but yes, absolutely, I agree. Yes, we didn't have a term for it. Well, I mean, I did. It's called stupid, but I'm like, yeah, there are better, absolutely better and worse ways of doing it. And there are people that absolutely do that. They're like, well, as long as I don't eat. But again, this goes to the missing the big picture. To them, as long as I don't eat meat, I'm healthy. As long as I eat clean, I'm healthy. As long as I eat X, I'm healthy. Nothing else matters. Nope, you've missed the big picture here.
Mm.
So the low-carb Mediterranean diet, which is a thing now, limiting whole unprocessed foods like vegetables, lean proteins, healthy fats, fruits in moderation. That, I think, would probably be the biggest difference. But, I mean, like, seriously, the list of foods is the same, you know, on this. Lean proteins, fish, fatty fish, poultry, eggs, and legumes. Healthy fats, olive oil, avocado, nuts, and seeds. Fruits in moderation. So, like, these are all sort of starting to come together. Because the early, absolutely early Atkins ketogenic diets was like, yeah, eggs, fatty steak, like I said, pork rinds in whatever fat you were dipping it in. Nice. I mean, pork rinds are just like deep fried nothing. They're gross. Not a fan. So yeah, and they're better and worse. You know, now whether or not it matters, like there is some stuff, you know, about blood lipids and ketogenic diets. I talk about this in my book. And again, there may be newer data. I can only keep up with so many things at once. But in general, despite the high fat intake, blood lipids invariably improve on a ketogenic diet because weight loss always improves everything, no matter how you do it. It just does. But there was some data that a maintenance intake ketogenic diet, blood lipids could get worse. But again, I haven't kept up with that. Would eating, this was early 70s, 80s data. Nobody was thinking in terms of healthy and, you know, that distinction in terms of like all dietary fats aren't the same and healthy fat, that wasn't a thing when most of the early literature on this was being, all the early research was being done. So I'm quite sure that the diets that were being given or eaten very different than, you know, the healthy ketogenic diet or the Mediterranean version or whatever it is, where, you know, because then you're eating, you know, like, because it is, you can eat super fatty proteins or you can eat lean proteins and add dietary fat to other foods. And those are very different things. And I think I did a combination of both. I mean, I will say heavy cream and protein powder with stevia, it is delicious because fat and sugar usually is, or fat and sweet usually is. But that was like that was keto dessert. We didn't have protein flow. Because we had it rough. Not like you kids today with your ninja blenders and your protein fluff and all this other stuff. We had to just get by on our own with half and half and terrible protein powder and a little guar gum so we could maybe pretend it was food. We didn't have konjac noodles. We didn't have any of that stuff. Because we were hard. You know what konjac noodles are, right?
That of course super I do. Yeah.
Fibrous veggie. Like, they're seriously, awesome. Like, yeah, use like that plus some lean protein and some veggies on RFL. You'll almost think it's real food.
You can have them on keto as well.
Oh, sure, because they're zero carbs.
Yeah.
I mean, they're great. They're just pure fiber. They're super chewy. People always bring up there's been a handful of deaths associated with them when people
what
eat.
The I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. Someone in my group went histrionic. Don't eat too many of them. You could die. I'm like, okay, you're going to have to show me some data. Okay. One was in an older Japanese man with no teeth.
Yeah.
So he couldn't chew them and they clog him up. Another one was a woman. It was all case studies. Who started eating 4 packets a day of it and it clogged her up. Okay. Don't do that.
Did they get like a bowel obstruction?
Yeah.
Because,
don't mainline that stuff.
There's a chubby emu video about a guy who made marmalade out of Metamucil. And he got like a fecal impaction.
Oh, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, there were, so back in the day, right? This is back in the 80s. when they release, like, oh, guar gum helps with weight loss, right? Well, yeah, it's soluble fiber and it just swells in the stomach. And people started making guar gum capsules. You ever gotten a capsule caught in your throat?
No, like, fortunately not.
Like trying to swallow a pill? I have. Where it just doesn't go down?
God.
Well, that happens. And people would swallow a guar gum capsule and it would lodge in their throat. And it would dissolve. And the fiber would expand. And they would die.
Okay.
The worst I've ever experienced was a high heat capsaicin pill dissolved in my throat. And that was one of the worst experiences of my life.
Yes, no, I swallow a lot of pills, and that's fortunately never happened.
Yeah. And it's not common for me, but it does happen. And so yeah, like there, like you will hear every once in a while, but it's always people like just mainlining this stuff from zero and eating, like, yeah, don't do that. Don't eat and make sure you have teeth. I thought that was kind of a silly case study to throw at me by this person. But so I'm like, that seems a little histrionic to me.